There's nothing for the Fed to panic about. Like, it's not all growth is collapsing. We have to respond. So they're in a tricky spot. Global core inflation moved up from the usual level around 2% to like 6-7%. And now we've come down most of the way.
Welcome to The Big Picture, Opto's new macro show in association with Market Reader, where each month our mission is to decode the complex world of macroeconomics, sifting through an unprecedented amount of financial data to make sense of the forces driving markets. I'm joined by macro expert and co-host of the show, Jens Nordvik, previously a managing director at Goldman, a senior investment associate at Bridgewater, and head of fixed income research at Nomura. Jens founded Market Reader in 2021. In short, Market Reader aims to explain market movements by applying innovative empirical analysis that helps pinpoint the reason for asset price movement as it happens in near real time. Welcome, Jens. How are things?
Thank you very much. I've never done a co-hosting of a podcast event, so this is a first for me. So it's good to try something new.
Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us. So let's dive into our first episode. Our theme today is when and how rates will peak and how it drives everything. So I want to start by setting the context and revisiting the environment prior to the Fed's September meeting. We saw mixed signals, including core inflation momentum slowing, momentum within services growing. We had stronger economic forecasts with US GDP growth increasing quarter over quarter, while equity markets pointed lower, with small caps still around, I think when I checked yesterday, 11% off their most recent peak in late July. So at the time, what did you make of that mixed picture? How do you make sense of it?
So the Fed is facing some pretty serious cross currents here, right? Because on the one hand, the most important variable to them is inflation. And we've had better inflation data over the last 3 months. But the level was so much above target, right? That even if we have improvement for some months, we're not quite at the target yet, right? So it's going in the right direction, but they're not quite happy yet. And as you said, we've also had some economic data that has been better, right? So as opposed to what's going on in the rest of the world, U.S. growth expectations are pretty resilient and edging up on some measures, right? So that also means that, okay, there's nothing for the Fed to panic about. Like, it's not all growth is collapsing. We have to respond. So they're in a tricky spot. And the third variable I would mention is really financial conditions. So we have started to see over the last, should we say, month or so, right, that the actions that the Fed has taken, the communication that they did around the meeting, where they really sort of stressed that we're not going to be able to cut interest rates soon, right? So really the main message from this meeting was that rates are going to stay pretty elevated into 2024, whereas the market and the Fed itself previously had actually written down in their dot plots, right? We're probably going to cut 100 basis points next year, right? And they scaled that back dramatically. And what we've subsequently seen is that the market has gotten kind of worried about that. And some of the bond market volatility has come out of that concern.
If we think back to September, I wonder whether Market Reader, the tool that I mentioned in the intro to the show, would have revealed a clearer picture to what was going on at the time.
So what we're doing in Market Reader is that we track essentially a large section of assets in real time, and we use an AI technology to attach explanations to what's going on, right? So around an FOMC meeting, you will have the technology literally telling you, okay, these instruments are moving, and it's because of what Powell said, that's being revised down and so forth, right? So we'll give real-time color on those events in the tool. It's the kind of stuff I've been doing as a human for professional investors in my career that we've now programmed into a piece of software that can do it algorithmically, automatically. I might think that I'm doing a good job at doing that and I compete with it. But what Market Reader can do that's different is that it can do it for thousands of assets at the same time, something that a human could never do, right? So it's the scalability of it that's really cool to see in action.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk to the power of Market Reader several times throughout the episode. But returning to the Fed policy decision, they responded by choosing not to raise rates, as we've discussed, keeping the target for the Fed funds rate at 5.25 to 5.5%. Even at the time, several Fed officials, reading back through the commentary, said rates were likely at or near their peak. So obviously we're returning to the theme that we want to focus on today. What was your initial take on that response? A reflection of the mixed macro picture, perhaps?
Yeah, so I think what I've been analyzing the Fed over the last 6 months or so, it's typically been the most helpful to listen to the hawks. Like, the hawks have been in the driving seat. And what is changed is that even some of the previous hawks, like Waller, have actually sort of toned down their hawkish language, right? So I think the pause that we had in September was very much consistent with the hawks kind of chilling out a little bit, not feeling that there was a great urgency to hike further. They still have in the dot plot the projections for this year an additional hike penciled in, right? But there's no urgency in terms of delivering. And we can go into that later on, right? But really what has happened subsequent to the meeting is also sort of a bit of a reassessment as to, okay, even the remaining hawks, do they really want to deliver that additional hike? I think we've gotten some color subsequently on whether that's likely or not. That is relevant for thinking about the future here.
Yeah, great. Well, with that in mind, then, if we leave the past behind and talk about the present, to what extent do you think what we saw in September was a policy pivot, with officials now focusing more on, you know, how long rates will be at these levels rather than how high they'll actually go? And do you believe that this is a signal that the current hiking cycle is nearing an end?
For me, it's kind of like the market that reacted in a way that is then triggering a kind of policy pivot, right? So what we've seen subsequent to the meeting was that people really look carefully at the communication, right? And as I said before, like, this idea that there was going to be meaningful cuts next year sort of coming out. We've seen the long end of the bond market sell off very dramatically, right? Very dramatically in a space of a few weeks. And then we've seen a number of Fed officials come out and say, okay, we actually take those bond yields into account because of what the long end of the bond market has done. Maybe we don't need to do so much in the short end, right? So it's kind of like this interaction between the whole yield curve and Fed policy itself. And I would argue that the pivot has actually been triggered by this dramatic move in the long end that has made even the most hawkish members like chill out a bit. And for example, Lori Logan has definitely been in the hawkish camp, the Dallas Fed president, and she's come out and saying, okay, given what's going on in the yield curve, perhaps we don't need to do more. We've had Mary Daly from the San Francisco Fed say the same, and Jefferson, who is now the vice chair, presumably in very court coordination with Powell, has said something to the same effect, right? So I think the policy pivot didn't come directly at the meeting, but it came as a function of this price action we've had since the meeting. And I think that really reduces the risk of additional hikes this year. It's going to still depend on inflation, right? If we have a couple of high inflation prints in the final months of the year, we certainly can rule out that they will be forced to hike, but they don't really want to anymore. Like, given what they've seen, I think they feel that financial conditions have tightened sufficiently, not only through their own steps, right? But when I say financial conditions, what goes into that, right? It's clearly the what's in the yield curve, short end rates, long end rates. It's also what's going on in credit that has started to soften. And as you mentioned, right, we've seen some of the equity indices turn over. And the dollar is stronger as well, right? So through all the key pieces in the financial conditions index, we've seen some tightening, and that's what the Fed is starting to take into account.
Yeah, fantastic. And before we move on to what's likely next year, I want to stick with present day and talk to, I suppose, the other popular indicators that people use to track this stuff. We saw a spike in the most recent NFP data, for example. What do you think, if anything, we can take from that? I saw you describe it, I think, on Twitter as fluky. So were you expecting growth already, perhaps?
So really what I do for a living is to look at a lot of data, right? So if I look at the labor market, we can definitely share a chart on that as well. I like to literally aggregate all data that I can get my hands on in terms of what the labor market is saying. And if I do that, then we end up with a picture where we have a very gradual moderation in terms of labor market activity. Labor market strength is moderating, right? Whereas if you look at the NFP, we had like crazy spike, then it goes down, and we have a crazy spike, right? So I feel very confident that we can look through those crazy spikes and focus on that underlying trend that all the data together signals. And I think Fed officials view it the same way. Like they do 3 months moving, they do 6 months moving of that data to make sure that they don't put too much emphasis on one data point. The broad picture is that the U.S. economy is pretty resilient, more resilient than the European economy, but it still is like shifting gradually down, like one gear after another. And that's the path we're still on. And the payroll data doesn't change that for me.
Yeah, got it. And we're not here to discuss Xanto data, but it is another company that you founded and run. And I saw that one of the signals that you use on that side of things is an aggregated signals for the US labor market to limit the noise that comes with these NFP announcements. And I just wonder whether it might be worth referencing that here, because it speaks to your point about using a multitude of available financial data rather than one popular indicator. How exactly does that work?
Yeah, so we literally look at all data that we can collect. It could be, you know, consumer conference readings that relate to the labor market. It could be the challenger survey about people getting laid off, initial claims, all those indicators that come out every month, every week, right? We can aggregate them up and put them into a space that's comparable to the NFP release, right? And we just get a more robust metric that draws on much more data to tell us what's really going on in the U.S. labor market. Like, so for example, back in January, when we had that crazy 500,000 job gain, right? That was because of seasonal factors that impacted the NFP survey, right? But all the other labor market indicators were much more stable, right? So that's an example. Like, more data is better than less data. So that's the philosophy we generally employ.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with that philosophy in mind then, let's talk about last week's US CPI number coming in a little hotter than expected, rising 3.7% year on year, I think. Do you expect another rate hike? And well, we've already said perhaps not towards the end of this year, but maybe you can kind of correct me on that. Or what's most likely, before the end of this year or early next year? Do you expect the Fed to sit on their hands in November?
So I think in November, it's so close to where we are now, right? The Fed is not going to have a heck of a lot of new information. I don't think the last CPI release was like shocking to the Fed. I think the market had gotten optimistic that perhaps we could have additional improvement in this month, right? And the market that disappointed, but I don't think the number was very far from what the Fed was expecting. So I don't think that's going to sway them quickly. So I think for November, it would be very surprising if the Fed feels that they need to go, given what's going on with, as I said, financial conditions in the overall economy. And also, we have obviously very dramatic geopolitical uncertainty again, right? That's another factor that might, in the short term, impact how relaxed or what should we say, how urgent they feel it is to do something in addition. So I think really, if we look around the world, and I think this is something where we can also illustrate with a chart, we can really see that core inflation globally has come down very notably, right? So global core inflation like moved up from the usual level around 2% to like 6-7%. And now we've come down most of the way towards 2%. And I'm talking about the whole world here, like all economies that kind of matter, right? So we've made significant progress on core inflation, for sure. And in Europe, that improvement is actually pretty broad-based. It's like goods prices have turned, services prices are clearly starting to turn. So what's a bit different in the United States is that we've had a huge turn in goods prices. Like we had some kind of months where we actually had deflation, like used car prices were dropping fast and so forth. So we had a situation where goods prices were actually coming down, but services prices remained pretty sticky. And that's kind of still the situation we have in the US. So it's kind of ironic that we had in the US, the tightening cycle started early in Europe. But in Europe, the disinflation, the improvement in services prices actually started earlier, I think, which is part of what has been confusing to people about the global inflation outlook. So the key thing, the key question, and I think for the Fed as well, is, okay, what happens with these services prices? And you hear Powell talk about it all the time. He likes to look at core services, right? Because there's some volatile items and services you want to strip out as well. And I think there's some very good reason to expect rent-type variables to come down. And when I look at what's happening with wages in the United States, wage growth has also moderated. And actually, it fits a little bit with that higher headline print. A lot of the jobs that were created and we saw in the headline number that looked positive were quite low wage jobs. So there's normally a link between wages and services prices, and we would expect that to kind of kick in over the next 3 to 6 months. Whether it comes like 1 month or 2 months, it's hard to say. But I think from a medium-term perspective, I think there's a very good chance that that will start to show some moderation. And if that's the case, this is going to be very important for the Fed, right? Because then they actually can relax. Then they can say, our job is mostly done. And then it becomes a new question. Then it becomes a question, okay, when is it a time to cut rates as opposed to do we need to do a bit more? So that's a very, very different situation. And services price is absolutely crucial to that. I like to look at medians. So like instead of stripping something, I like just look at the median of everything. Like, and we have some tentative improvement, but not as much as in Europe. So key question, I think, for short interest rates and the whole yield curve is that going to improve in the next 3 to 6 months? I think there's a good chance it will. If that comes true, then the Fed will start to talk very differently as well.
Got it. Okay. So if that does start to improve in the next 3 to 6 months, the kind of bigger issue, I suppose, is what happens in 2024 rather than this year or at the end of this year. Yeah, talk to us before we move on a little bit how you expect them to behave towards the start of 2024 into H2.
So I think if we have a situation where all the key pieces of the inflation basket is rolling over, then you're going to start to look at, okay, what really is the correct level of interest rates? Like we've been in a situation where the economy was hot, inflation was too strong, right? So they needed to push in a tighter direction. I've been tweeting for a year, like nobody has a clue what the terminal rate is. And really, it is a very hard concept, right? And coming up with some academic rule for what the end interest rate is very tricky, right? But now we have found it sort of in a very practical way. We're very close to finding it. Once the inflation number starts to look much better, then you can say, okay, how long do we need 5.5% interest rates? Like, don't forget how long ago it is since we had interest rates at this level. We really have to go back to pre-global financial crisis, right? Early 2000s, mid-2000s. So it's a while ago. And I think if you look at what the Fed has put in to their public communication, like they have this so-called long-term dot, right? Where do they think the equilibrium is longer term? That is 2.5. Like they think the long-term kind of equilibrium level for the Fed funds rate is 2.5. That has been drifting a little bit higher. But like do you put in 2.5 or 2.75, there's a long way from 5.5 down to that level, right? So if they get comfortable with the outlook, we can have substantial cuts. So I don't think the Fed is going to be in a rush. But I think what could be interesting is if we get to Q1, the inflation outlook looks a lot better. I can imagine, especially if global growth is weak, a situation where the market is going to say, okay, we're past peak. Now we're going to think about like really how aggressive the cutting cycle could be. Is it going to be every meeting? Is it going to be once a quarter, right? And really what's interesting about the yield curve is that for the first time in a long time, we don't have aggressive cuts priced anymore. Like that whole period where we had aggressive cuts prematurely is kind of over. And now, actually, it could be a big surprise if the Fed is forced to cut aggressively from the second half of last year, next year.
Yeah, got it. And is it too early to anticipate what that cutting cycle might look like? Or do you have a sense of how that might go?
So let me put it this way, right? If the Fed is comfortable with the inflation outlook and growth is moderating, then why can't we get from 5.5 to 3.5? Like, so I think it used to be the case that we thought of 3.5 as high interest rates right now. So it's, we have to, there's a recency bias, like we get comfortable with a certain number, right? But I think if the Fed is not revising what they think is kind of like long-term equilibrium, then like, okay, going to 3.5 is actually not very ambitious. That would still be above what they think the long-term number is. Like you can say, okay, if they keep 2.5, maybe we're going to get back to 2.5, right? So that sounds aggressive now, but like what the point I want to make is that if the curve is pricing 100 basis points of cut from the middle of 2024 to the middle of 2025, that's really actually not that aggressive relative to where the long-term dots are. And I would like, I don't know when you want to get into now, but I would like to get into a little bit about how to think about the long-term in the context of the AI discussion. Because this is like one of these wild cards, right? That we've been in a certain type of economy for a long period of time. We got used to zero interest rates for a long period of time. There are a number of variables that suggest that we should move back to low interest rate, like demographics are weakening and so forth. There's a number of variables that point in that direction. So the one variable that has potential to signal something really new, well, maybe there's two. But one of them is definitely the AI discussion, right? If AI is going to really boost productivity in the economy, there's historically a link between what is sort of the trend growth productivity and what real interest rates can be, right? But real interest rates have already moved up very, very dramatically. We were used to having literally zero interest rates. And up until recently, we had, 1%. Real interest rates, and now the 10-year real interest rates touched 2.5 at that yield peak we had a couple of weeks ago, early October, right? So that's just a big move. In order to justify that, I think there's the AI discussion is definitely something I speak to clients about, and some of them are very bullish on the AI dimension. We think they think productivity can be boosted, but it's just we've been used to like very low productivity growth, like 0.5% productivity growth, 1% productivity growth. Can we really justify to have real interest rates that are 2.5%? Or if you think bond yields are going to higher, that implies potentially even higher than like 2.5, like 3%. Can we have 3% real interest rates? It's so different from the debate we had like not that long ago, 2 years ago, right? So it seems a bit dramatic. And I also, like the fun thing about, I do a lot of fun stuff, but like professionally, we use the AI technology within Market Reader, right? Like we have a combination of structural modeling, finance models, economics models, and the AI. And we can do a lot of stuff that we can't do without it. So I can certainly see it, like I have my hands on it, right? And it's incredible what we can do with that technology. But there's a lot of companies that are investing in AI that I feel that the return on that investment is not something that's going to be very immediate. There was a very interesting KPMG survey that was out recently that we can perhaps also weave into this, where they asked CEOs, when are we going to get the return? And the large majority of CEOs said, it's not for the next couple of years. It's 3 to 5 years out. And if that's the case, it's going to be something where like the Fed is going to like have theoretical views on AI, but they don't really respond in policy until they've seen it in the data, right? So if the data is only going to show these productivity gains in 3 years, in 4 years, in 5 years, like how are they going to set policy on it now? So I think they're going to be very reluctant to do that. And that's why when I look at those real interest rates, I'd say, okay, yeah, that is just an incredible move. Like from zero real interest rates to 2.5 in such a short space of time. And I'm not talking about the 2-year interest rate. I'm talking about the 10-year, like really what should be sort of a long-term trend. And I think we're getting into territory there where there's going to be investors that say, okay, that's actually nice, real interest rates. I can get those real interest rates and be inflation projected. And sit back and not do other very risky investments instead. So that's the one aspect. The other aspect of, okay, how do we get these very high bond yields is if you worry that there's just something totally new going on with supply of bonds. And I spent a lot of time analyzing flows in the bond market, right? And when you look at what's going on in the bond market, it's very tempting to say, oh, is China selling a lot of bonds, or the Japanese don't like U.S. bonds anymore because they have higher yields in Japan because of the yield curve control being abandoned. But like when I crunch all that data, like, I don't think the China selling is particularly big. It's like actually pretty marginal. Japanese have actually started buying again in the last couple months. So that's not really what is the big thing. Like, there is more supply. There is quantitative tightening, right? So the Fed is not absorbing bonds anymore. They're actually pushing them back into the market. So that supply is big and it has an impact. So I think when you look at the bond market, one thing that is super crucial is to realize that historically, and I did a tweet about this over the weekend because I think it's a very important point. Historically, the peaks in the short yields have been almost identically timed with the bond yield peaks. Like, so you go back in the 2018 cycle, actually the 2-year and the 10-year peaked on the same day in that cycle, right? You can go back into the 2006 cycle, the 2020 cycle, the 95 cycle, 84th cycle and so forth. The peaks in the short rate and the long rate are in most cases extremely close to each other, right? So like the point I'm making here is that when you analyze the bond market, like don't think about like the bond market as like some kind of like thing that's living on its own planet, divorced from what's going on in the short on the yield curve. Those two things are very closely related, right? But we have to acknowledge that supply issue is pretty unique. Like, we have incredibly large fiscal deficit in the US, and there might be some of the demand forces from abroad that are also less strong than they used to be. So there's some pressure there. But if you really have a turn in the short end of the yield curve, right, 2-year yields start to go down, the Fed is about to cut rates, it's going to feed into the long end as well with an incredibly higher probability. So, there's just this tendency to have one narrative about what's driving bonds, and that's the supply story, right? And that might have been the correct narrative for the last couple of months, but it doesn't mean it's going to dominate the price action forever. And I think we're getting into a period where the peak in the short run is closer, and therefore, historically, that has also meant that the peak in the long run is getting very close.
Yeah, really interesting. And that conversation about AI is definitely one that we should return to further down the line. I want to move on. I think we set out the central theme of this interview as, you know, when and how rates will peak, which I think we've discussed. We've set that context, but how it drives everything and the impact it will have, particularly on equity markets, I know will be of specific interest to our audience. So let's move on to that part now. You know, we saw the S&P 500, for example, if we use that as a benchmark, that retreated around 5% in September. And that was its second straight losing month and its worst performance since December last year. So we've seen US stocks call back some of those losses this month, but it's not been a complete upward trajectory for US equity markets. So should investors see this as a signal that equity markets are beginning to price in the peak rate narrative, or is it, like most things, a little bit more nuanced than that?
Yeah, I think the market is extremely confused. We're getting closer to a turning point, but I think one variable that is very interesting is the volatility you're seeing in the bond market has actually gone up, right? So you'd think if you're getting close to the peak, you say, then the sort of ranges start to get narrower, right? Because we're probably not going to move that much, but that's not what we've seen. And we've seen that the long end of the bond market remains incredibly volatile. Like I open up my Market Reader ETF monitor every morning when I start the day, right? And almost every day, the most volatile instrument is TLT, i.e. the long bond ETF, right? The same today, right? So we've seen that many days in October, right? Where incredible volatility. So that means the market is certainly not comfortable. It's not confident that we have this peak yet, right? We don't know where the bond yield is going to end. So I have my views, right? But the market is definitely not confident yet. If the market got confident, it would be a big deal. We have to really think hard about, okay, how does the yield peak come about? There's sort of two ways where you can get the market thinking, okay, we're at the yield peak, and they can be very different, right? So the one is the one we've talked about, where we say, okay, services prices look better. The Fed get much more relaxed about the inflation picture. They're never going to say they're relaxed, right? But let's call it less worried than they were. If that's the case, that's kind of like a bullish way of the peak being put in place, right? Because it comes from better inflation numbers. And I think we've seen that pretty clearly as well, right? When we have that constellation, yields moderating because of good news on inflation, the equity market certainly likes it, right? So that would be the easy scenario to spell out. And we can have concerns about valuation and so forth, but from a shock perspective in terms of what is new, that will be highly likely to actually support the equity market, right? The problem is it only going to be that, or are we going to have the other type of peaking process where it's really the recession fear, the growth problems, and so forth that come into the equation, right? So if I was going to outline a path that I think is pretty likely, it would be one where the inflation numbers start to get better. The Fed responds saying, okay, we're also getting more comfortable. The peak is in. We're gonna be thinking soon about how to cut and so forth. The equity market's going to like that. But I wouldn't be surprised if we then, over some period of time, still have economic weakness entering the picture. Fiscal policy is finally turning in the U.S. after having been more easy than people thought for a period of time. U.S. politics are very complicated. We have like stalemate in Congress and so forth. And growth turns out to be a lot weaker. So it's kind of like, for me, it's a two-phase thing where the first phase of the peaking process is a positive one that comes from inflation. And then it's sort of like the next shoe to drop could generate a further decline in yields, but would actually be much more challenging for the equity market because it emphasizes the growth concern. That, I think, is the most likely path. That's a very dangerous forecast to do because it has a lot of elements in it. But I think actually that path is a pretty likely one, and one that could play out with initial phase, right, lasting some months, and then there's sort of a next leg. I think we've seen that in previous cycles as well. And that it just is crucial to differentiate and try to sort of separate is one or the other. And at some point, they'll probably commingle. But I think for me, when I look at all the U.S. activity indicators, right, and one of them is the labor market indicator that we talked about a little bit earlier on, right, there is very little evidence of dramatic deterioration. A lot of the sort of loss of momentum in the U.S. economy is very gradual. It's not the falling off a cliff. And like one indicator I like to look at in the U.S. is nominal income growth. Like how much extra money do people have in the pocket, right? And that can come from more people getting a job. It can come from wages going up. It can come from people working more. It can come from obviously tax effects and transfers as well, right? But if we put all those things together, we're still in an above normal income growth in the U.S., not as extreme as 1 year ago or 2 years ago, right? But it's still above normal. And that makes me think it's unlikely that we're going to fall off a cliff, right? So I think that's why we have this window where in the next 3 to 6 months, the improvement in the inflation outlook might be the dominating force. And it's only later on when those income dynamics start to flip and we have job losses and so forth, that the growth dimension becomes the dominating concern for the equity market.
Okay, got it. And we've got a lot of retail equity investors listening in, and predominantly they're invested in growth and tech within that. So I'm keen to finish on a kind of practical kind of outlook for the tech segment of the market. And maybe your outlook for that market might differ across those two phases that you nicely kind of laid out just there. But give us a sense of what you're anticipating in terms of the tech sector equity market outlook.
Yeah, so the tech sector has some very interesting elements to it, right? Because the tech sector is also where the AI theme is captured, right? So we've seen this incredible divergence between what the broader stock market is doing, right? And then what those specific names that are most likely to take advantage of the AI theme have been doing, right? And I find that theme very hard to fade, right? Because we have companies that have resources to invest in AI. Like, we're not talking about a million there, here and there. Like, we're talking like, okay, this is like literally a $10 billion investment like that Microsoft did in OpenAI and so forth. And they have data, right, where they can use that data for training purposes, right? So it's very hard to fade that momentum. That said, I would say we are also starting to see some changes in terms of what are the leadership, right? We have seen not just traditional tech, right, but we have biotech names that are now seeing incredible moves, right? So maybe I'm slightly biased, but there's a Danish company called Novo Nordisk that is one of the best performing stocks this year, and they are moving up the ranks of the biggest companies in the world, right? So they were outside top 20. I think on Friday they were in the 14th biggest company in the world, right? And there's a couple of other U.S. pharmaceutical companies that have incredible products in the pipeline, right? That really have potential to change how people think about health. I've seen it in Market Reader over the last couple of weeks, where we say, okay, what the heck is going on with, you know, all these medical equipment companies? And the reason they are collapsing is that people are starting to believe that these new drugs that are coming to the market will mean that all these different other medical services provider and equipment providers are not going to be needed anymore. Like, it's quite dramatic. Like, so tech, I think what is tech is also changing, right? And there's actually some biotech companies that are suddenly coming in, and there's a revolution going on in that space. And we used to think about, okay, who's going to be the next trillion-dollar company, right? Is it going to be Tesla? Is it going to be Amazon and so forth? But we have actually some biotech companies knocking on the door there. So I think people have to think differently about tech going forward. So very, very interesting shift going on in that space. And I think you will see that the trading that is happening on your platform is going to be start to really gravitate towards different names in the next couple of months.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, well, a fascinating insight, I think, to end on. That just leads me to say thank you very much for joining me on this new show. Jens, it's been a real pleasure.
We'll do it again soon. It's good to try something new.